Hi, I'm Stephanie Marland, and welcome back to the My Little Eye podcast. My Little Eye is my new thriller coming out on the 5th of April about a group of true crime addicts who meet online and attempt to catch a serial killer before the police. So what better reason to put together an online crime podcast series? In each episode, I'll be chatting with expert guests about murder, crime, and the facts behind the fiction. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Chris James Carter, who's an assistant professor whose research focuses upon social media ethics. Me and Chris met while we were both working at the Open University, and we collaborated on research into how people behave and learn in virtual environments. So welcome, Chris. And to start with, why don't you just tell us a bit about your research into online ethics?
Okay, thank you, Steph. As we've seen in My Little Eye, in fact, as well, there's been a huge increase in social media research. It's become something that that the research community is becoming increasingly interested in, and with that it's brought lots of questions about ethics from doing that kind of research. So I've started to look at various different aspects of that. One of them is particularly you might be aware of big data. So one of the issues there is about how can you do research that involves big data but still take into account that there's a kind of person behind that data, that someone has contributed that data somewhere and it might be meaningful to them. So one of the research groups I've worked with while I was doing my postdoctoral work was looking at, can we take a citizen-centric approach to that? So in other words, can we do research that kind of still uses that value of huge data sets but kind of takes into account issues of consent and you know, the ability to withdraw and just knowing that they've taken part in research, because a lot of research now that uses big data, people don't necessarily know whether they've actually contributed that. So that's some of the stuff I'm working on. I'm also school ethics officer for my business school at Nottingham, and that involves also kind of reviewing other people's research projects. Oh, okay. So there's a kind of practice part as well as the research part as well. So.
Yeah, cool. So in My Little Eye, my PhD researcher, Clementine, does some pretty dodgy things in the name of research, like breaking into crime scenes, for example. So as someone who specialises in social media research ethics, you know, how do you feel about that? And what are your kind of top do's and don'ts around the subject?
Well, I think if Clementine had submitted her PhD research project to the Nottingham University Business School, I think I would have been a little bit worried about the breaking into crime scenes part, if that had been in the proposal.
So she should leave that bit out.
She should probably leave that bit out and just generally not do it in the context of a proposal, I suppose. But you know, I guess, you know, so that's my official line. So in terms of do's and don'ts. So for social media research, I think the core things to take into account are actually very similar to kind of any kind of research that involves human data. You're still The core guiding principle is still, you know, kind of trying to prevent doing harm to your participants. So, you know, that's the core fundamental thing. So in that respect, you know, when you talk to people who are doing social media research and you're saying, well, you know, kind of how do you navigate some of these issues that we have online? Actually, the guiding principle is exactly the same. And that's the same as well for things like consent and, you know, kind of being able to withdraw, trying to keep people's identities anonymous if you possibly can, trying to keep data confidential, though all those kind of issues still kind of remain the same. But of course then you've got a kind of layer on top, a layer of complexity on top of that, and one of those aspects of complexity is around the kind of public and private. So for example, in My Little Eye, when Clementine's, you know, kind of on a kind of online forum and is participating in this, if she had submitted her project, you know, through the proposal, I would be thinking, well, you know, is that community, do you have to subscribe to that community? Do you have to make your identity known? Do the other people in the community know that you're researching, that you're participating in research? You know, how well informed are they that they're taking part if they were to become part of your subjects? as that. So yes, there's some interesting, I think it touches upon some interesting elements, her particular situation as well. It's a very complex one. And actually, you know, when I think about her particular research and her thesis, I think, well, I think it would probably strike fear into a lot of ethics officers across the country, because they'd be thinking, well, how on earth do we review this? You know, and actually that's something that I do research into. So I'm kind of at the moment researching into academic attitudes towards some of these issues. You know, how are they thinking about data? So one of the do's, I suppose, is to actually just consider that data is potentially different. You know, so data can persist over time. You can potentially have your identity exposed by piecing different pieces of data together, even if you think that you're keeping a participant anonymous. So even if Clementine was to try and disguise some of the other people in the forum in her thesis, it could be that the things they said could be Googled, for example, and then they would be found, you know, and potentially exposed. So there's all sorts of issues. It's not to say that research shouldn't be done, or that, you know, that those issues would stop a piece of research going forward, but you'd want to try and consider those things beforehand. I think the important thing is about ethics, from the ethics perspective, is not eliminating the risk, it's controlling it and understanding what you'd need to do if something did happen. It's very difficult to eliminate it completely. But that's the same with any kind of research. Mm. If you have an experiment, sometimes you might, a social psychology experiment, for example, sometimes you will need to deceive people about the task, which, you know, if you were trying to plan the perfectly ethical experiment, you would never use deception. But actually sometimes there are good reasons why you need to do that. And for the same thing, if you're researching an online community, there might be a good reason why the people who you're researching shouldn't know about it, because they might change their behavior if you're trying it. But at some point down the line, ideally, you should tell them that they're taking part in this, possibly, depending on whether you think that their data is public or private. It gets very complicated very quickly.
Yes, it sounds like
And that public-private distinction is kind of, in some ways, fundamental to every... It's the fundamental debate that kind of is beneath every single piece of social media research, because it affects how you treat the ethics of that data. If you think it's public and fair game, then maybe you don't need to get consent to do it, because maybe there's a reasonable expectation, because someone's put their data and their behavior out there, that you can research it. Just in the same way, if you were an ethnographer and you went into a cafe, it wouldn't be feasible to ask every single person in that cafe for consent. You could treat it like that, or you could argue that from the opposite perspective, well, actually, you know, people are putting their data online, but they don't necessarily know that they're going to be taking part in research. So you should still try and ask them in some kind of way, or try and get consent. So that's the kind of fundamental distinction which runs throughout all of this research, and it affects how you treat, you know, so depending on what Clementine's take might have been on that and her discussion with her supervisors, you know, that would really kind of determine whether she would even do the kind of research that she ended up doing.
And she's probably quite a risky proposition.
But I mean, that's aside from the breaking into the crime scene. I'd probably rather not know about that. But it makes for an interesting thesis.
Okay, so just sort of thinking about that a bit more, the digital footprint that people start creating from the moment they go online and using social media can be huge and last for a really long time. How aware of this are the students that you work with looking at online brand?
I think this comes quite a bit into the other strand of research I do. So aside from the kind of social media ethics, I also look at reputation management, and particularly how young adults think about risk to their reputation just before they're about to go into the workplace. And also starting to look at entrepreneurs when they're starting out. And it's difficult. I think there's a kind of key word in this, which gets used a lot in academic study, which is around curation. So it's that kind of the idea of curating an identity for yourself online, because there's actually a great, really interesting paper by Bernie Hogan, which talks about this metaphor of the exhibition So it's like identity as, rather than like Irving Goffman's kind of whole thing about, you know, presenting yourself, we're all actors on a stage, and, you know, we have our backstage behaviors and we have our front stage behaviors and we have an audience in front of us. What Hogan talks about is actually, rather than using a stage metaphor, it's more of an exhibition metaphor. So we're kind of curating our lives rather than performing them, which kind of makes sense in a social media perspective, because the way that social media is structured, you know, like it, data sticks around, you don't always see your audience, you don't know who you're acting to at any one time. Sometimes your behaviors will be accessed way down the line by a totally different audience. It becomes about curation and kind of thinking about what you're willing to put out there. And so I think when you mentioned about brand, I think that's really important, because social media, from my perspective at least, has become that kind of space where we can build brands for ourselves, we can build careers, and there's a positive side to digital reputation management, which is, you know, and you know this, I'm sure, very well as well from kind of blogging, and, you know, you can utilize or even kind of leverage that platform to really kind of reach audiences which you may never have been able to reach, or talk about things to people you may never have been able to talk or connect with people. So that's great. And that's probably one of the greatest things about social media. It's very empowering. It kind of democratizes, you know, you don't have to come from a privileged background or be, you know, kind of super wealthy or whatever, or part of an elite network to access those people anymore. You can fire off whatever characters it is now. I can't remember how many characters are in Twitter now.
280.
Yeah. You're tweeting too much. That's, yeah. Absolutely. that was a trick question. So, you know, you can reach those people. So that's a positive side. The downside of that is that people are now faced, because it's a brand, they're faced with the same challenges and risks that companies are typically faced with when they're managing their brands.
Right.
And of course, companies typically have, depending on the size, will have an entire department quite often dedicated to crisis communication and, you know, PR and doing that. Of course, now we all have to be our own PR people.
Yeah.
We all have to regulate our behaviours and put on our PR hats and deal with situations when they come up. So it's a lot of responsibility for people to take. It's which they're sometimes not aware of or capable to do. Some people handle crisis better than others. We see that from celebrities online when they've said something. So I think the branding side of it is really crucial. And in terms of students thinking about that, from my research, they do think about that a lot.
Okay.
But the problem is that they don't necessarily think about it in the moment. So they might know that they shouldn't be saying something that could affect their careers. But they think, well, do you know what? That's off in the distance somewhere. So I can probably get away with it now and I'll just deal with it later on. But of course, as we know from the internet, it's very difficult to sometimes deal with those situations later on. It's, you know, once Pandora's box is open, then, you know, it's out there. And it's far harder to kind of retroactively sort of deal with something, whether it's deleting it or obscuring it in some kind of way, than simply not saying it in the first place. So I guess to answer about students, yes, they are aware of it, but they don't necessarily always feel, and quite understandably, that they should be thinking of their boss when they're 14 years old or 15 years old, because why would you?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so that opens up a question, which I guess I'm looking at a little bit now, which is, should we be encouraging young people in particular to be considering that type of thing when they're 14? Automatically we might think yes, because we don't want them to put themselves at risk. But on the other hand, what does that mean for the internet and how we kind of create identities and brands on the internet? Are they simply kind of middle of the road, nice, risk-free, you know, corporate sheen identities? Or is there any space anymore for being a bit individual and a bit risky? Because, you know, as we know, actually, it's a very complex balance to get.
Yeah.
The people who succeed best on social media tend to have something that distinguishes them. And to be distinguishing, you often have to be doing things which are by definition different.
Yeah.
And if you're doing something that's different, that opens you to risk. So it's, you can see why I sometimes go and sit in dark corners and, and have a lie down from thinking about
this. Well, the way I try to limit risk myself is that if I have two glasses of wine, that's no more social media that day.
I think that's a limit. really good plan.
It's my rule. One of my few rules.
It's a very good rule, because otherwise, you know, the GIFs start getting used and, you know, you end up using seven emojis and, you know, people start suspecting that something's up. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. But how do you, you know, from your experience of Crime Thriller Girl, you know, sort of was that, you talked about brands, like, did you have that in mind for yourself when you were kind of consciously creating a brand, or did it just kind of evolve?
I didn't particularly consciously create a brand, other than at the time I was anonymous to start with. And so I just had like kind of cartoon icon. And that kind of became a bit of the, I suppose that became a bit of the brand. It wasn't about me as a person. It was about, you know, female sleuth looking at crime books and talking about crime books. So, yeah, I did kind of start off thinking I was mainly going to talk about books and anything book related. So I didn't talk about what I'd had for lunch or, you know, a frustration in the day job that day or the fact the train was late or something. I talked about books, but I would also, if I went out to an event that was book related, I would talk about the book event and I would post pictures of people at the book event and stuff if I'd have my pitch taken with them and things like that. So it was kind of, it all had to link into the fiction.
Yeah.
So I guess that's the sort of decision I took early on. I think calling it, like, thinking about a brand would probably be a little bit more strategic than I was.
That's a good, it's a really good point, because I think the other thing is really interesting, because so I do sometimes talk to people about building personal brands as part of the kind of business school and stuff. And one of the things, it is very much, like you say, strategic. Like, when you're thinking of it like that, it's like saying, well, how can you plan out this thing? So I say, you know, it's about authenticity. It's not about creating something which is not you. It's because you can't sustain that over time. You can't be someone else for that length of time and be authentic. People respond to authenticity.
Yeah.
And I kind of think, you know, with your blog, that kind of behind this, almost like behind the scenes kind of, you know, what does crime fiction look like behind the books themselves? You know, how do authors interact and what do they do? And the circuits that you go on and the tours that you do and the talks that you give and all that kind of stuff is really interesting.
Yeah.
And to get that sort of industry sort of look. But it's really interesting, I think, when you say about it's very focused. It's like it's clear what the purpose of that blog is. You're not diluting it with other stuff, which would be very easy to do. So I guess it's interesting, because you say it doesn't feel strategic, but it has a very clear focus. So it's something which I think people, which funnily enough, I would say to someone, like, okay, look at this blog. This is, you know, you need to be strategic in the sense that think about, you know, not diluting it with too many things and have a clear focus on what you're doing. Because if you do too many things, people just, they don't know what they're meant to be responding to. Am I responding to Crime Thriller Girl talking about behind the scenes in the industry, or am I interested in her pictures of her lunch, which seemed very tasty and interesting, but like, I could look up, you know, my mum's lunch on Facebook, because that's what she posts, you know.
I think people quite like it if I do a picture of a book with my dog. That works quite well. I think I do use him for appeal sometimes, shamelessly.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I've been doing the same with cats as well. You know, I mean, you know, the internet loves dogs and cats.
Exactly.
So, you know, if you can fit a dog and a cat in with whatever your subject, I think you'd be talking about, you know, finance, and you could be, as long as you're including a picture of
a cat in the corner with an Excel spreadsheet.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's my USP, you know, cats and finance. It's absolutely not cats, maybe, but finance.
So I find social media and its impact on personal identity a really fascinating subject, and I kind of explore some of that in My Little Eye. I wondered what kind of trends you're seeing in that area.
Yeah, so I think I'm bound to say one of the trends is the area of research that I do,
as
sort of like a bit of a plug. But so I think, joining in slightly from what we were saying before, one of the trends is around, I think, reputation management, and I think that's more maybe public identity in a sense rather than personal, maybe, because I think the thing with reputation is it's kind of a kind of identity, but it's a shared identity in a sense that your reputation it might well be very close to how you think of yourself, but of course it could be wildly different. You might well be known socially for things you really don't want to necessarily be known about, but they stick, and you know, that's what happens. So it is a very kind of unique, special kind of identity. But I think there's a lot of there's increasing research going on into that, my own, but also many other really good researchers looking into this about risk, how people manage that, what kind of behaviours do they kind of engage in. So it crosses over all sorts of disciplines, you know, goes from everything from PR to digital marketing to social psychology, I guess, and some of the theories we talked about before. And of course, there's a great book by John Ronson, which, you know, is the book that I really wanted to write. I mean, he essentially stole my book away from me without even, you know, sort of realizing it, but did an even better job, which obviously really compounded my feeling of deep regret. But so if you get a chance, if you haven't already, read So You've Been Publicly Shamed. And he talks about a lot of the cases which really inspired the kind of research I do, which is this issue of, you know, people being shamed very widely, like to audiences bigger than you ever could have imagined before, through saying silly things, really, not really thinking things through, perhaps maybe telling an off-color joke, which normally would maybe just get a muted response from your friends in the pub or something, say, but because you're saying it to an audience of potentially millions, then you can, you know, lose your job and, you know, lose your career and your livelihood potentially. So there's some really great research as well as public stuff around that. So I think that's definitely a trend. And you're seeing companies who are dedicated to trying to manage people's reputation specifically, you know, try and scrub Google search, you know, Google search responses in there and in the search engine first page, you know, trying to drive them down to other pages that people don't look at. And, you know, they're charging a lot of money to not just celebrities, but to regular people who this has happened to, you know, people who have, you know, found themselves elevated to a kind of more public position, but they've been held accountable for something they said as maybe a 14-year-old. So, you know, there's a whole industry that's growing around this. So I think that's definitely an area that's coming up that's about identity. I think the other thing which I don't do research in, but I think is really interesting and very kind of on topic at the moment is around kind of artificial intelligence and social bots and also kind of machine learning. So the big thing that's happening right now at the beginning of 2018 is around this issue of deep fakes. I don't know if you've kind of come across this. Okay, so to set some kind of context, what often happens with new technologies, the first context in which they're used is often porn. So this has happened with deepfakes. So so deepfakes are essentially, it's a machine learning algorithm. And what it does is, and I'm apologize to any experts on this, by the way. So this is my fudged, you know, layperson description of this. But essentially, it's people using an algorithm that's kind of publicly available. And they can scrape kind of publicly available images of, let's say, a person. So typically celebrities, because we have this huge database of photos of them.
Sure.
And the technology has become so advanced, really, that they can program this this algorithm to essentially put on someone's face onto a piece of video footage. So whereas, you know, before people might have been able to do it quite well with photos, they're now able to do it very realistically with video footage.
Wow.
So to one of the things they've done and has become a, well, it's interesting to note that this has actually been banned on many different platforms. So Reddit did have a subreddit that was dedicated to this. People exploring the technology, but as I say, often using it for kind of in adult entertainment. But the problem with it is, as you probably already imagined, is that they can take someone's face and put on someone else, and it looks very convincing. So
that's pretty scary.
It's pretty scary. It's pretty scary. And so it kind of, again, comes back to reputation again. So if someone, it's feasible that you could show someone a video and say, look at this footage of this person saying this thing. And actually, it's a completely computer-generated piece of footage. And they actually demonstrated this. I was seeing a video the other day of, I think, Obama, and they were taking two different speeches, and they were showing how, you know, even though he'd never said this speech in a different context, he was able to say it in this video because they managed to, you know, obviously, so many photos, be able to do it. So you can imagine the political consequences. You can imagine reputational consequences. Anyone who's in any kind of public, you know, publicly visible position could be at risk, you know, because it's very difficult to then tell what's real and what's not real. So I think the kind of most pressing thing for us to kind of get a handle on in the next kind of, let's say, decade, 5-10 years is the real and the unreal and what that is. Fake news, if we're going to put it bluntly.
In video.
You know. It's, yeah, but in video, absolutely. So this is not just, you know, bots that are retweeting things to bring them to the top of engines, or it's not, you know, allegedly fake Russian accounts, you know, kind of liking or setting up fake accounts. This is, you know, kind of very realistic looking videos that show people saying things or doing things which they never did, which could be very convincingly taken as them actually doing it. So it's it's on the one hand, it's fascinating from a technology point of view, but it's also terrifying from what it might mean. So I think we're going to see a lot of research around that, and we're going to see a lot of people very, very much trying to not only manage their reputation, but also possibly even have issues for how they perceive themselves. Did I even do this? I can't remember whether, you know, like, is it, who am I anymore, you know? Because there is a reciprocal, you know, kind of relationship. It's not, you don't just put yourself out there, people perceive it and then create the thing. You know, we often put things out there on social media and then we learn something about ourselves by how other people react. But if someone's in control of that, you know, there's a big question about how do we feel about ourselves if we're seeing these videos of ourselves saying or doing things that other people think are true but aren't.
So obviously you have a lot of reading of academic articles and journals and books that you do for your work. But what kind of books do you like to pick up when you want to unwind?
That's really, I love this question. So it makes me feel quite guilty, actually, because I feel a bit detached from, you know, sometimes from reading for, I don't know, inverted commas, fun. I do like my job, though. So, you know, I do, there is a, it is fun still. But yeah, I mean, I guess I used to be particularly, I used to devour, absolutely devour, you know, kind of particularly legal kind of based, you know, all the Michael Connelly kind of Harlan Coben, you know, like John Grisham and, you know, all these kind of writers, really absolutely loved those kind of novels. So if you look at my bookshelf at home, it's a little bit eclectic, but mostly you'll find a pattern emerge where it's something, something Grisham, something, something Connolly. And then, you know, that kind of pattern goes. I think more recently I've really got into kind of comics or I suppose if I was being a bit fancier, graphic novels. but yeah, they're really comics, you know. But there's some really great ones out. And I took some recommendations from friends and, you know, Guardian lists, I'm going to be honest, you know, like what do I go for? Mm. And I'm so glad I did because I ended up reading things like Mouse, which is by Art Spiegelman, who it's kind of basically a kind of telling of the experience of the Holocaust, but using sort of anthropomorphic, you know, sort of characters, and sort of little mice. And it's kind of really interesting and like very kind of, as you'd imagine, given the subject matter, dark. But it's amazing to see how that kind of form, like what's typically seen as maybe, you know, sort of a, you know, possibly slightly childish kind of form is like can really deal with these kind of big subjects. So that's really interesting. There's some, in the same kind of topic, there's things like Chris Ware, who has done some really interesting, on the face of it, quite mundane kind of graphic novels. So he's got a book called Jimmy Corrigan, Smartest Kid on Earth, which is incredibly thick. It's very difficult to take around with you in a bag. Same with his Building Stories as well. I remember buying that collection and it comes in like a big, it looks like a jigsaw box. It's got about 7 different books and it's sort of basically telling stories about the buildings themselves and then the people who are within them. And it's like, if it was a film, you'd probably say, oh, this is very slow. It's like not a great deal is happening. But that's kind of the really interesting part of it. You get really sucked in by the sort of mundane things which are kind of happening. It sounds a bit strange, but
it sounds a bit voyeuristic.
Yeah, it is. That's totally right. Yeah, it's like when I first read Building Stories, it felt a bit like looking into a doll's house, but someone else is kind of like moving the pieces, you know, like watching my sister play with the doll's house and making the stories, you know. It's that kind of, it is like quite voyeuristic to look at it, but it's really interesting. And Alan Moore's stuff with, you know, Watchmen, which I think is an interesting crime book in itself, if you were to like interpret it in that way, From Hell and that kind of thing. And I really like Daniel Clowes as well. So, you know, Ghost World as well, like the kind of that was made into the film with Scarlett Johansson. And he's got an interesting book called David Boring. And like, again, it's sort of like these sort of like quirky individuals. So I'm really interested in that at the moment, about how, you know, these kind of authors can use this form to tell these really interesting stories and like narratives and things. So
yeah, it's cool. I've only ever read one graphic novel, which is V for Vendetta.
Perfect.
Which is a brilliant
one. It's brilliant. I love that book. It's really interesting. So did you watch the film as well?
I've seen the film.
Did you read the book or the film first?
I saw the film first and then I read the book and then I watched the film again, because you kind of get a different thing each time. So
I'm not as far as that, so I did the same as you. I watched the film then read the book, and I really keep on meaning to see the film again.
It's really good. Okay, so we're going to close with a question submitted via Twitter. It's very topical given your academic discipline. So this question was submitted by @CraigLai, who says, there's a constant problem with trolling online. What do you think is the psychology behind these aggressive online attacks?
That's a really good question. I do find this fascinating, and I'll give a slight disclaimer. It's not my area of research specifically, and I do run the risk of stepping onto other people's ground who are far more well-informed. But as far as I understand it, I was kind of looking into this a little bit. I think what's interesting about it is that it seems to pull on these kind of like the dark side of psychology, which I think a lot of psychologists, we're sort of, particularly social psychologists, are inbuilt to kind of be fascinated by. You know, it's like a very human kind of thing to be interested, you know, in these kind of naughty things that people do. In fact, a lot of my research I can summarize as people doing naughty things that they shouldn't be doing. It's
Professor of naughty things.
Professor of naughty things, which is possibly not an advisable title. But there was a study that was done by, I think, some Canadian researchers, which was looking at this thing that they call the dark tetrad of personality. And basically that's made up of narcissism, Machiavellianism, psychopathy, and sadism. And what they wanted to do was, that, as far as I understand it, they had quite a big sample, and they were looking at, looking at people's personalities and whether there was a kind of correlation between people who enjoyed kind of trolling behaviors and whether there was any kind of relationship between that, you know, where they featured on this. And as you probably have already imagined, you know, there tended to be this quite, you know, kind of significant relationship between people who are particularly high on these factors, these kind of dark side factors, and their propensity for wanting to be trolling. So what they kind of concluded was that, and I really love this kind of quote, if I'm getting it right, but they essentially conclude that these trolls are prototypical everyday sadists. And I think that's kind of tallies with what we know of trolls, really, in the way they behave, because what they're really interested in is that they're essentially taking enjoyment out of the distress of others. Mm. There's no wider plan. There's no kind of content related aim to what they're doing other than simply just trying to get reaction and then taking enjoyment out of it. So in terms of the psychology of it, I think it plays into those kind of, you know, sort of, you know, those dark side, you know, kind of slightly sadist, psychotic kind of tendencies of just enjoying seeing other people kind of really get in a bit of a state about, you know, what they've said and what you've said in response to that. But I think what's interesting there is about how you deal with that then. So there's a kind of part to that question, which is, well, if that's what it's about, which it makes sense that it is about, then how do you actually deal with trolls
yeah.
if they're doing? And
yeah.
I think the advice that the authors of the paper give and that I would agree with too would be actually ignoring is usually probably the best thing. If you don't respond, you deny them that enjoyment. You simply deny them. So
yeah.
by not engaging. But the problem with that is, of course, it's difficult not to engage if someone is, sort of saying terrible things or
yeah.
really taking what you've said perhaps out of context or something. Actually, something I was wondering myself was, you know, whether you'd had any experience of anyone trolling as well.
Not in the sense, I think, that our question from Twitter is kind of, you know, that sounds much more serious than anything I've luckily had. But I did, I was on Woman's Hour in January. And there is I was going to say a guy, but it could be a woman. I'm just, you know, making an assumption
yeah,
here
yeah,
that it's a guy who every time it seems that Women's Hour tweet about a guest,
right.
then comes back with pretty horrible things about the guest or the subject matter, very anti-women.
Right.
And if you sort of look at their tweet line, I mean, it's amazing how many hundreds of tweets this person has
right.
spent their time sending just
yeah.
trying to troll that show.
Yeah. Yeah. That kind of provoking response.
Yeah. So I did get some tweets from them at that time, but
yeah.
you know, it's very minor compared to what
yeah.
what other people have been through. I mean, there's some horrendous cases.
Yeah, there's some awful ones. And as I say, when I say it's kind of almost content irrelevant or content free, it doesn't matter what the person's tweeting about, the responding to it, does it? It's just this desire to provoke that response. It could be about anything. I mean, you know, it could be about the most benign of subject matters whatsoever.
Yeah.
And it's, they just want to prod and poke
yeah,
and
attack.
Get that. An attack, yeah.
yeah.
And usually, as you're right, it's interesting because, you know, that kind of assumption that it is, you know, probably, you know, kind of a male doing it, because I would suspect from the research it shows that it predominantly is.
Okay.
I admittedly don't have the empirical evidence to back that up, but I would suspect that probably is the case. And yeah, it is an interesting thing. I think I was wondering actually for like Clementine as well, do you think the future, without wanting to try and expose your future you know, storylines and plans for Clementine, but do you think that you know, kind of trolling would ever come into factor into maybe some of the stories for her, because it seems very
relevant. It might I'm not being drawn on this. It might.
Steph is now winking very very aggressively and doing something with the throat. What are you doing with your throat, Steph? So, telling me to stop talking. Okay, good.
So, a huge thanks to Chris for joining me today. Be sure to join me next week for another episode of My Little Eye podcast. But first, here's a short extract from the audiobook, which is available to buy now.
The shrill, repetitive beep of his mobile jolts Dom awake. He fumbles for it on the floor beside his bed, his sleep-addled brain making him clumsy. The caller rings off before he can answer. It's too bloody early. Still dark outside. Groaning, Dom rolls over, his back muscles aching as he reaches out for Therese. He's only 43, but he feels bloody ancient. Her side of the bed is cold, and it makes him remember. She's not stayed here in nearly 2 months. He's sore from the 2-hour workout last night. A session that only ended because the gym was kicking out at 11:30 and he couldn't persuade any of the fitness team to stay late. He didn't stretch, didn't drink enough water. He knew he'd pay for it, and he is. His head is pounding. The training session hadn't helped him sleep anyway. So he buried himself in the murders he's working, going back through the case files he shouldn't have brought home. Two young women, Jenna Malik, found dead 4 weeks ago, and Zara Breton, who died 6 days ago. He's still got nothing to connect them except for the way they were killed and the anguish on their loved ones' faces when he broke the news. Even after 19 years on the force, it never gets easier. The memory of their distress is a constant reminder that Jenna and Zara were real people with real lives, and their deaths affect others, the devastating ripple effect of murder. It makes the fear even greater. A killer like this always kills again if they aren't stopped, if Dom doesn't stop them. He doesn't want that on his conscience. There's enough weighing him down already. He tried to sleep, but was still awake at 3, thinking about her. Always her. Just like every other night since things went to shit, he couldn't stop the memory of their last argument replaying in his mind. He'd screwed up, big time. He never meant to hurt her. The phone in his hand starts to ring again. This is Bell. Gov? The nasal tone of Abbott. We've got another one.